And we're going to switch gear. There you go. That can't walk on my own button, as we call it. Thank you, Charles. We're going to, for the rest of the hour, talking about the stuff of life, actually the very essence of the word organic, and that is carbon, but not just any carbon, but the beautiful molecules of pure carbon. Chances are that some of you in the audience, as we speak, are wearing pure carbon. Some of those, some of you might be wearing diamonds, and I see it's a woman looking at her diamond ring right now, knowing that that's a pure carbon and a crystal lattice. It makes it very strong. Some other people, I don't have my pocket protector on today, but let me assure you that when it's on, it has some pencils in there, and it's got graphite in it, and that's a form of pure carbon that's not very hard at all because it has a different structure to it, how the atoms are arranged in it in little sheets that slide past one another, making it very slippery. Well, back in the mid-1980s, my next guest and his colleagues discovered a third kind of pure carbon, and they called it Buckminster Fullerenes. Because they looked at Buckminster Fullers as geodesic domes and say, hey, they're built exactly the same way. And they got to be known in the short version as buckyballs because they had a very particular shape. The carbon atoms were arranged in a sphere, just like a soccer ball. You know, the soccer ball has two different colors on it. Well, that's exactly the different arrangements that a buckyball has, pentagon and hexagons that are connected together. And there is really an interesting story behind the discovery of the buckyballs and where the discovery has led and where it is going. And here to talk about it is the man who made that discovery. Harry Kroto received the 1996 Nobel Prize in Chemistry. He's a professor in the Department of Chemistry and Biochemistry at Florida State University. And did you know you had a Nobel Prize winner living right here amongst you, right here in town here? And I'm very happy. Dr. Kroto, thank you for taking time to be with us today.
My pleasure.
How did that discovery come about? I got about 2 minutes to the break. Let's see if you can give me a capsulized version.
Well, it fits very well into the origin issue because I'm intermediate between Lisa and Sean because I was interested in what was going on in stars, carbon stars, stars that produce carbon. All the carbon in your body is produced in a carbon star. And it blew your carbon atoms out into space. And they landed up here in this room today. And you're lucky to be here because most of the people who could be here in the empty seats are still out there. And a lot of people around who I think we should send back out into space as well. Basically, I was interested in some discoveries we made earlier by radio astronomy of carbon, which was in the interstellar medium. These were carbon chain molecules. And one day I ended up in Rick Smalley's lab with Bob Curls, a friend of mine, and he was jumping around, fantastically brilliant character, and he had this laser vaporization system which vaporized silicon and carbides. And it struck me we could simulate the conditions in the star, which is basically your mummy. I mean, that's where your carbon came from. And to understand the chemistry, and when we managed to get around to that experiment, it worked perfectly, exactly as I thought it would, but there was this crazy C60 molecule turned up at the same time, and it's blighted my life ever since.
We'll see if we can make it even worse for you today. We're going to have to take a break and come back more and talk with Harry Kroto about buckyballs and Buckminster Fullerenes and bucky paper and all kinds of new kinds of things. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. I'm Ira Flato. This is Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flato here in Tallahassee at Florida State University talking with Harry Kroto, who received the 1996 Nobel Prize in Chemistry and who was the first to discover the buckyballs. You were telling us a little bit of that history, that you tried to imitate what was going on out in the deep recesses of space and right there in your laboratory, and out popped these buckyballs.
That's exactly what happened, and so we can conjecture that these things are out in space as well. And that's not yet proven, but I think they're there.
And what was so special about the properties of these that made them different from the diamonds and the
Well, first of all, they're actually pure, as opposed to diamonds and graphite, which are not.
They're not pure.
No.
That's a myth. Oh, we're dispelling a myth all these years.
Well, what is on the surface of diamond? There will be hydrogen and hydroxyls and OH groups, many groups, so the surface will not be actually pure. It's actually not carbon. There are things attached, atoms attached to it.
Impurities.
And C60 is the only pure form, so you should pay me
Wow.
What you're prepared to pay for your diamonds if you're...
Can you make...
If only.
Can you make me a buckyball of 3 carats is the question.
Yeah, I think...
You can't do that yet, can
no,
you?
No, but it's an interesting point, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think the major aspect of the discovery of C60 is that it changed our whole perspective on the nanoscale world and what we call self-assembly. What happens is we allow things to assemble from the bottom up, and that's nanotechnology and nanoscience. Mm-hmm. And it, to some extent, catalyzed a new perspective, not a new area of science, but a new perspective on the way that the 21st century chemistry and material science will move. Mm-hmm. We didn't really fully appreciate that something as symmetric as this would self-assemble. And in fact, the first 5 papers said we were wrong.
Really?
I mean, yeah. It's an interesting point. We didn't have to wait for them to die to prove. We actually just shoved it down their throat that we could actually make it after 5 years. And I mean, it's an important point. When you have a paradigm-shifting breakthrough, it's very hard to actually accept. And it was difficult for us as well.
Right.
I mean, in a sense, it seemed like when you take all the balls on a billiard table, they would, and then throw them on the table, they would automatically end up in the triangle or on the snooker table. That's what it appeared to be. But in fact, people hadn't fully appreciated it was energy-driven and not what we call entropy-driven.
Right.
So now we understand that, and now I think we can move on to this new world in which we're going to assemble, say, chips from the bottom up by chemistry.
Give us an example of what you're talking about. What's the potential for kinds of products? So we could make computer chips that way, you're saying?
Well, let me just make a dig at you.
I like digs.
Basically, I think it's an important thing that people in fundamental science always get a bit worried about, is that we're always asked, what are the applications? And to some extent, we're not driven by that.
Right.
Fundamental science is driven by just curiosity. Mm-hmm. And so what I would emphasize is that our breakthrough really changed our views about, I think, two-dimensional space, two-dimensional materials, how they would behave. We used to think graphite would just be flat. Well, it's not. We know that in small dose bits, it will curl up and close up. But I will get round to the applications, but by and large, that's what people want. If they're going to pay scientists to do science, they would want some payoff at the end. And to some extent, what has happened, what always has happened, is it's difficult to convince people to pay money just to have a good time.
Right.
Mind you, they don't worry about kids. I mean, we're just big kids, really. So you want your kids to have a good time. You don't mind that they don't go out to work for a while. But by and large, what happens is they uncover unexpected things. And fundamental science does that. I think it uncovers the big surprises that no one appreciated, no one thought was going to be there.
Such as? Give me some of the big surprises that it uncovered.
Well, DNA is a good example of a big surprise. Who would have thought that this breakthrough would have been used 50 years later to free someone from prison who had been in prison 25 years? Now, there was no way that you could predict DNA fingerprinting. And some here in Tallahassee, this gentleman who was in 25 years for a crime he didn't commit. So in a sense, it's the fundamental science looking at the way the world works, which brings the surprise they didn't expect. Lasers are a good example. I mean, who would have expected that everybody would have a laser, in the supermarkets just to work out what was going on. Everything
you can make for just a few cents.
Absolutely. Unbelievable. Yeah. And Charlie Towns would never have dreamt about that. And I asked him, I said, well, what makes you most satisfied with your discovery? He said, when a gentleman came up to him and had his sight sort of, he had later eye surgery and could see again, he said, that's nothing. He could never have expected anything like that. And I think that's why we have to be very careful about what Lisa was saying, that we need funding for fundamental science, because out of that fundamental science, the unexpected discoveries lead to the massive breakthroughs. And if you're only looking at applications and strategic things, you leave this other area of very important ones behind.
Well, what fundamental things don't we understand yet about this world?
Well, I think we really don't understand self-assembly very well, in the sense that it should be possible, and this goes back to your earlier statement about what applications, we should be able to dip a sort of disc into into a chemical dish and then bring it out and we've got a DVD, okay? Or we should be able to pour two chemicals together and make a computer.
I mean, that should be possible.
Well, you know, we are the best.
We're self-assembled.
You are an example of nanotechnology, nanoscience. If you call it atom by atom, molecule by molecule, assembly of a complex and some not so complex organisms, then that's nanotechnology. So when people say, oh, you know, I heard something that 60% of Americans think that nanotechnology is immoral and unethical. Well, they should all get dropped dead then, because they are examples of nanotechnology, because you've been assembled atom by atom, molecule by molecule, on the basis of this fantastic DNA blueprint. And so when you understand that, well, if you can be assembled by evolutionary process into what we are, we should, you know, we're in the 21st century, we should be able to assemble a transistor by this method. And I think we're on the way to doing that. And that's very exciting, which means that you could probably put a supercomputer into your wristwatch, you can lower the energy consumption. We should be able to build bridges that won't fall down in earthquakes. We should be able to print solar cells onto thin plastic sheets instead of using newspapers. I know newspapers are a problem, but some of them are not worth printing, I might point out. So, but some of them are, and unfortunately the ones that are folding are the ones that are worth printing. But we should be able to print solar cells onto thin plastic sheets and cover up, you know, large parts of the world which probably should be covered up, you know.
All using the self-assembly of nanotechnology.
We
should be able to set up a set of instructions to make something like our DNA makes something. It's a blueprint.
Yeah.
And say, do it and watch it self-assemble.
Well, it's been done. That's what we are. So it can be done. We just have to learn from biology how to do it. But we also have, it would be nice to be able to do it outside aqueous solution, because we're sort of, all this is in water. Some of the processes that we're familiar with, sort of electrons, they conduction is really in a non-aqueous system, and that's hard. That's where we should now make the breakthrough and learn from nature how to do that.
Are you not fearful of what Michael Crichton wrote about in Prey, that these self-assembly things would get out of hand and become intelligent?
No, we've already got mosquitoes around here, which are, let me just say, we can't even make a mosquito, right?
Right.
If you want to know a fantastic animal, it's a mosquito. It can sense you there. It can land on the ceiling upside down. And the closest we've got is a helicopter. And you try and put a helicopter on the ceiling.
Closest thing to a mosquito we have here is a mojito. Let's go to the questions right here.
You talked about curiosity and having fun. I wanted to hear your thoughts on exciting young people about science, going into the field, and maybe doing some of the things that you've done.
Well, they're already excited about these things up to the age of 8 or 9 or 10. The problem is boys meet girls and girls meet boys at that age, and that seems to be a stumbling block. Some manage to get over this by the age of about 15 and 16 and decide science is better than the girls, you know. But I'm being facetious, but it is a problem. And I think the biggest problem that I see is that the language of science is mathematics and symbolism. And if you don't learn that much earlier, then you may never be able to appreciate it so much. The curiosity is there, but it's like a language. If you can't speak Japanese, it's very difficult to appreciate the culture of Japan. And if you're Japanese and you don't understand English, it's very difficult to really appreciate Shakespeare. You can get the story, but the real culture is a problem. And there are many other... I mean, every scientist you speak to has their own pet view of this. And my pet one is that the world now is too easy for our young people who are now 15, 16, 17 to get along with. They don't need any common sense to survive. Their mobile phone works, and when it doesn't work, they throw it away because they can't fix it. There's nothing fixable. There's nothing that is like the world that I had, because if something broke, I had to fix it, okay? So the radio didn't work. I took the back off. The fifth valve on the left wasn't lit up. I could see how it worked, took it out, put a new one in.
Because they were made to be fixable.
They were made to be fixable.
These things are not made to be fixable.
Well, that's true. I mean, my wristwatch here is liquid crystal display. It has basically microprocessor in there. It's got computing capacity. It's made out of a material we didn't know. It's got a little battery in there. This is 35 years old, and it's still working. It's fantastic. But if it didn't, if it stopped working, that's it.
Just chuck it out.
And I, as a kid, I had a watch, a pocket watch, and I opened it up, and I could see how it worked. So our kids don't know how this world works. And that means we're now in a situation. We used to have common sense. Huh. And that common sense told us that the sun goes around the earth. Uncommon sense of Galileo was, let's just check this out. No, it doesn't. We're rotating. What has happened now is there's not a lot of common sense, the hands-on things that we need to survive, and there's a lot of common nonsense. And especially in the evolution debate here in Florida.
All right. I'm surprised it hasn't come up yet.
I had to make a comment.
we're talking about we're talking with Harry Kroto this hour on Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow with Harry Kroto, who is a 1996 Nobel Prize winner in chemistry. Do you want to talk about it at all while you have a chance?
Not really. It's very exciting. I would like to say, I think, for young people who go into science to win prizes, don't do that.
Don't do it.
I went into science because for a job, and I was very proud of what I'd done by 1984, 85. And I was successful. There was no hope of a Nobel Prize. Then we made this unbelievably exciting discovery. And then think, maybe so. But if we hadn't made that discovery, I would have been very happy with what I'd done. Mm. But I would say that one other thing is that I think we have to use the communication network for children now. And that's one reason why I'm here in Florida,
right,
is that Florida State wanted me to work on educational outreach using the internet, and that's what we're doing, and what particularly aimed at teachers. We have a GSET program, Global Educational Outreach for Science, Engineering, and Technology, aimed at helping teachers to teach better. I think we've got to forget saying, we've no science teachers. We've got to use what's out there. We're not going to change that in 20 years. How can we do that? Well, Google, Wikipedia, and YouTube, I call it the goo-you wiki world. It's changed everything. It's going to leave you guys behind if you're not careful.
Hey, I'm part of that goo-you wiki world.
Yeah, but I think it's shown that we can change the dynamics of teaching by giving people out there a mechanism for their creativity to be put into a world cache of information. And Florida State's just going to be the place where we're branching out to other places.
All right. We'll see. Speaking of a young world, let's get the last question from a youngster in the audience. Yes.
How did you come across buggy balls?
Well, as I mentioned, in the mid-70s, we did some radio astronomy, which you were just saying that had nothing to do with anything on the Earth. I'm just interested in what was in space. We found carbon out there. Then, for about 5 or 6 to 10 years, I think, why is it there? And then looked at these carbon stars, which had been discovered, which were blowing your carbon. You were actually, all your atoms, your carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen atoms, was once inside a star. It's unbelievable. You're a bit of stardust. I thought it was fantastically exciting. I wanted to understand the chemistry in that star. In Texas, Rick Smalley, who sadly died 3 years ago, had developed fantastic apparatus for vaporizing carbon with a laser. You take a laser and you vaporize metals. So I suggest, let's vaporize some graphite and simulate the conditions in the star, the chemistry in the star. And it was, as I said, it was just perfect. Everything worked, except for one thing. This damn C60 molecule turned up. Huge peak saying, look, you're wasting your time. Look at me. This handsome C60 molecule. I'm the most important guy on the block, and it turned out to be so. And then we didn't know what it was. It had 60 atoms. And then both Rick and I had been to Expo in 1967, long before you were born. In fact, probably before your mother was born. That was a problem for me. So Buckminster Fuller's ideas were in our minds, and on the basis of Buckminster Fuller's geodesic structures, we worked out what the structure was, and then we found out that it was the same as a soccer ball, and I couldn't believe it.
Well, Harry, we have to get you out to talk some more, because you are the best walking example of how good a teacher can be. I mean, with your explanation and just your enthusiasm, you know? I know I'm part of the Moogle world. I'm not going to be part of that, but you have this gift of the gab.
Thanks a lot.
No, and I'm glad that you have the burden of explaining this because you explain it very well.
Okay. Well, Bruce had a snake, but I've got Indiana Jones's hat, you see.
There you go. All right. There's no better way to round up our show today than to say thank you very much, Harry, for Harry Kroto, who has received the 1996 Nobel Prize in Chemistry. He's a professor in the Department of Chemistry and Biochemistry at Florida State University in Tallahassee. I want to thank all of you who turned out today to here at FSU and joined us on Science Friday. Thank you all for taking time to be with us in the audience today and for those great questions. I also want to thank a special thanks to Frank Stevenson of FSU, who invited us here and made us feel very well, and all the staff at FSU who have made our stay so enjoyable. Also, we'd like to thank Greg Smith, who composed our theme music, and help today from NPR librarians Kim Molesky and Susanna George back there in Washington, and Nathan Bark, our engineer in D.C. If you have comments or questions, please write to us at Science Friday, 4 West 43rd Street, room 306, New York, New York, 10036. Also, surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where we're podcasting and blogging. Flora has our Science Friday video pick of the week. If you want to see that snake wrestling out there in the wilds of Tallahassee, you can go see that on our Science Friday pick of the week. Also, we're blogging and podcasting and Second Life and everything we can think of to take advantage of this new web world that Harry was talking about that we hopefully will be part of. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week back in New York. I'm Ira Flatow in Tallahassee.